people are...
Is there one upstairs in the year time?
Uncharacteristically late tonight.
Okay.
So tonight, we are talking about... Are we starting at 7:30?
Yeah, 7:30.
Oh, so, okay, that's fine.
Wait, you started...
Well, no, because I thought... All right, so let's get started at 7:30. Good evening, everybody. So tonight we are really, in a sense, beginning the conversation about modern Jewish nationalism with these very early figures from the mid-third quarter of the 19th century, Rabbis Alkaline Kalischer and Moses Hess. But before we jump into them, I want to review a tiny little bit just to help us transition from what we talked about last week to this week, because I think maybe some of the linkages that get you from the period of the Enlightenment, figures like Mendelssohn to those figures, perhaps are a little bit unclear for us, and there's a lot of really interesting, important stuff that happens in between them. Not all of which we can talk about, obviously, but just to at least feel like we can make the proper connections. So we ended up last time talking about Moses Mendelssohn, and we talked about him as this bridge figure. On the one hand, he's still a traditional Jew. He speaks a dialect of Yiddish, a German Jewish dialect, a kind of a West, what we would call, in terms of the history of the Yiddish language, a kind of a Western Yiddish. Comes from an observant family. His father was a cantor. He has no interest in significantly modernizing his Jewish practice or liberalizing it in any conventional sense of what that might have looked like. He already could see in his time in the third quarter of the, he dies in the early 1780s, he already knew that Jews were liberalizing, at least to some degree. And yet, he is regarded in many ways as the first modern Jew. And what we talked about last time suggested that the reason why he's the first modern Jew is because he recognized one crucial fact about the nature of modernity, and he accepted it. That crucial fact was that Jews were going to have new opportunities based upon new states and new ways of thinking that was going to open up for them the possibility of a much more profound, hopefully organic, integration into these emerging modern societies and states, becoming citizens and the like. And the crucial move that he makes is both a kind of a moral philosophical one, but also a strategic one. On the moral and philosophical level, he argues, we did not talk about this last week, he argues in his most famous work, Jerusalem, he argues that in fact, Judaism doesn't promote a separate morality. That morality is really a function of your humanness, not your tribalness, right? In other words, the thing that ties us together as human beings is the fact that we all have minds, we have brains, we can think morally, we can make moral decisions, and that doesn't come from Sinai, it doesn't come from the Hebrew Bible, it doesn't come from the Quran, it doesn't come from prophecy. It comes from the thinking human mind at work. That, of course, is a revolution in many ways, because that, on a moral level, is sort of the equivalent of E equals MC squared, right? The idea that says, well, you know what, if I make a claim about the natural universe. I'm not saying, well, that claim about the natural universe only is true for black people and not for white people. True for Christians and not for Jews, right? That's the greatness of science is that it ties people together inside of a kind of an understanding of the universality of things. Mendelssohn is really saying, he's not the only person who's saying this, but other figures like Kant are saying it as well. And Mendelssohn is saying that morality is universal too. And that then enables him to make the argument that being Jewish is not a barrier to Jews sort of swimming into the stream of the Enlightenment and emancipation and becoming citizens of Prussia or France or, you know, wherever. The problem then, of course, is once you've made the argument that says, well, you know what, Jews drink from the same moral fountain as everybody else as a function of their human faculties. So then the obvious question is, okay, so then why be Jewish? If you've made such a compelling argument for the universality of things, so then what's with all the crazy, weird Jewy rituals? The Shabbos, Talith, Tefillin, Kashrus, you know, blah, blah, blah. And in the second part of the book, Jerusalem, he in effect kind of crawls back to the cave a little bit. And he says, in effect, yes, but those things are the ceremonial script. Those things are the things that were revealed at Sinai to the Jewish people. And as divine legislation, those are things that we do that script us to serving God and becoming his holy people. And so he's got, in effect, one kind of from side, and he's got a liberal, universalist, enlightenment side. And that's how he tried to kind of square the circle. And the reason why, therefore, you saw the text that you saw last week in terms of opposing the maintenance of the excommunication was because he was saying, in effect, look, you know what? We are no longer going to be a political community because we now have a new political identity as Germans. So we ought not to possess police power to sanction people. How are we going to get people to believe, to want to continue to live a Sinaitic life? We're going to have to teach them, and they're going to have to just believe in it and do it, as opposed to doing it as a function of corporate power. That was a huge gamble, because he, in effect, was saying what we all say today as modern Jews, which is, look, you know what, I want to be committed to something, but I want to make a commitment on a voluntaristic level. And it's hard to do that because it means that a kid who doesn't get enough playing time on the lacrosse team says, to hell with it. I'm quitting. The rabbi looked at me cross-eyed. I'm embarrassed. I'm quitting. And the question of how you build voluntaristic community, I think obviously is a question that we all struggle with in our own different way. So that was a challenge that he felt, in effect, you couldn't avoid, again, both for philosophical reasons and for political reasons. So the outcome of Mendelssohn is that on the one hand, he has created a kind of a worldview that is congenial both to people who want to take on new political identities and become citizens and feel universally connected to their brethren, to their neighbors. At the same time, he tries to make the argument that says Sinai still matters, Kashrut still matters, Torah still matters in the traditional sense. Somebody asked me last week, you know, who are his descendants? And I would say that his descendants are both the reformers and this emerging neo-traditionalist group that, of course, today we call the Orthodox. How are the reformers his descendants? Which piece of him did they seize upon?
The morality side.
The morality side. That says we embrace this kind of new liberalism in religion, and we want to internalize that. We want to focus on that which ties us together to what ties us to our non-Jewish neighbors. We are very comfortable talking about religion as, in effect, ethics, like the Protestants do. They de-emphasize what piece? The Sinai piece. The frummy stuff. The Orthos do what? How do they claim Mendelssohn? Yeah?
They embrace the other side.
That's right. They embrace Sinai.
I'm having trouble understanding how you go from one point to the other point. Because the first side, you said he was the first great Jewish speaker, modern one. And if he's saying that the idea of Tikkun Olam is not exclusive Jewish,
yeah,
it's part of nature.
He's not the first one who says that. This guy named Maimonides said this also.
Really?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, Maimonides also said, this is the most radical side of the Rambam. The Rambam says that the way to know God is through metaphysics, is through doing philosophy. So who can do philosophy?
Anybody.
Anybody. Which then should raise the question, okay, so then what do you need the Torah for? This is his, by the way, this is his famous portrait of Abraham. He says, Abraham is like Mozart. How old was Mozart, his first sonata? What, 5, 7, some crazy age? Abraham is Mozart. Abraham is Picasso. Seeing things that nobody else sees. Hearing things that nobody else hears. The stuff, the greatness in their head, in their eyeballs. In their fingers coming out through their paintbrush. Abraham is a metaphysical genius who comprehends truths about the universe on a metaphysical level that nobody else sees. It has nothing to do with Torah. The point is he's a boy genius. That's how the Rambam depicts him. Mendelssohn was a great student of the Rambam. And in that way, Maimonides in some ways is really saying, okay, so what is tradition? Like, what is shul and kashrut and all these crazy laws? That's for the rest of us who didn't get 2400 on our metaphysics SAT test. The rest of us have to go to shul and learn how to daven and put on tefillin and study Talmud, blah, 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 blah. But if you're a metaphysical genius, the presumption is you could sort of like pass go, collect your money and just keep on going. You don't really need Torah for that. So that, of course, that the Orthodox will never tell you that side of the Rambam. So that, I'm sorry that was a very long answer to a short question. Did that help you?
A little bit, but I'm still seeing, I can't get how it goes to the second part. You said he sort of twisted.
He jumps. You're right to wonder about that. Well, that's right, and many people, including a very good friend of mine, wrote an entire book about this in which he also argued, as you just did, and you picked up on it in about 10 minutes, that part two is pretty weak. Meaning, on what basis are you ultimately saying Jews have got to believe in Sinai, right? In other words, is it just loyalty to the tradition? Is he just sort of trying to get people to stay inside of the sacred circle? That's a problem. He doesn't really give you a theology of how it is you're going to get back to Sinai. He just says you've got to accept it. That, you know, that this is our script for retaining loyalty to the corporation, in effect. When he's already, in some ways, kind of destroyed the basis, philosophical basis of the corporation. So that's an inherent weakness in his thing, and that's what enables each of these groups, in effect, to pick out, to sort of centrifuge out the piece they like, and to discard the rest. Right? The Orthodox saying, yeah, let's focus on Sinai. The Reform, let's focus on universal ethical monotheism. And the two are very... Now, of course, as I said at the very end last week, the key point, though, that you should not forget is that even the Orthodox and the Reform, as much as they seem to be arguing about stuff like kashrut or not, like, okay, yeah, Charlottesville is kosher and Temple Shalom is not, that's the stuff that we always kind of obsess about. The truth is, you know what, last time I checked, they're all American citizens. They've all made the crucial political move that says we are going to adopt the political identity of the state in which we live. In other words, they both accept the fact that Judaism is no longer a politics, it is a religion. And in that way, the Orthodox are as Protestant as the Reform are. Even if the Reform are not eating challah, then the Orthodox are. Don't let the challah throw you off the scent. Other questions or comments about Mendelssohn? Okay, so that's where we left off. Ben, did you have a question you wanted to ask? Did I miss you? Okay. So that's where we left off last time, which is that the crucial dynamic, and Baron sort of took us from the Middle Ages to the modern, was that Jewry seemed to be going towards a strategy that we would call integrationist. Right? The idea that says the world is going to become increasingly progressive and dynamic, more intellectual, more technocratic. The Industrial Revolution is the most obvious kind of piece of that. Democracy, right? The American Revolution, you know, new ideas about science and the like. The world's going to become more progressive. We want to join that. And that means that we're going to integrate into the larger world intellectually, but also civilly, politically. And the question then becomes, okay, so then what does that do to any sense of Jewish national identity? So that's really the point of departure for what we're talking about tonight. Okay, and the question is, how do we get from the period of around 1800, the French Revolution and the like, Mendelssohn dies in the early 1780s, how do we get from that tremendous sense of transatlantic excitement. Think about the French Revolution, the American Revolution happening roughly at the same time. How do we get from that sense of excitement about the Enlightenment and scientific universalistic ideals? Think about a figure like Jefferson, perhaps most famously. How do we get from that period to, in effect, the renationalization or the beginnings of at least a movement in Jewish life towards a pushback against universalism, a pushback in the direction of Jewish nationalism. This begins to take root in these figures like Alkali, Kalischer, and Hess. How do we get there? What's the kind of the missing link? So I put a few notes up on the board, which I realize are, you know, could be in Sanskrit for all you know. But a few jottings about nationalism. Because that really is the missing link. Right? In other words, what we will see throughout our study together of Jewish nationalism is that in some ways it's quite derivative of nationalism writ large, which is not a particularly profound criticism, and it's not a damning one by any means. The point is, Jews are living in societies like the Balkans, Prussia, these other places, and they're participating and they're observing conversations about identity, which very much oftentimes revolve around the question of the nation, this idea of the nation. And they're learning from those things, just like much later on, Arabs will, in many ways, internalize all sorts of attitudes about nationalism based upon their proximity to Zionist nationalism in Palestine. I mean, this is what nations do. They watch and they listen and they learn and they sort of invent off of those learnings. So what's nationalism really about? Excuse me. What's nationalism really about? Anybody have a sense? I mean, if I asked you, what is a nation? What are things that come to mind in that term? Yeah. Where's your wife? Is she all right?
She's at home with the grandson.
Ah, okay. A semi-valid excuse. All right. Yeah, so what are some things that you associate with nationalism? Yeah?
Language is
Language. Alright, good. So let me do this up here. Language. Okay, what else?
Common values.
Values.
Geography.
It's good. Okay, what else?
Ideals and aspirations.
Ah, nice. Kind of a future thing. Future aspirations.
Laws.
Okay.
Government authority.
Government. Right, and you could sort of say institutions.
Shared history.
Okay, history. Yeah. Yeah.
Race.
Interesting. Some sense of the tribe. Whatever that means, yeah. Good, yeah. Peter?
Economic values.
Economic values and behaviors, presumably. Some notion of this economy.
Education.
Yeah.
Education.
Okay. All right. What else? I mean, that's a lot. I mean, these are really good, important things. Yeah? That.
Common agreement on a system of governance.
Okay, some notion of consent around government, yeah. Which goes to the issue of legitimacy, obviously. Right, government is legitimate, presumably, to use our language, the popular sovereign, you know, the consent of the government. Yeah? What else? Yeah?
Common defense.
Defense.
In other words, armies and navies and all that.
Yeah, absolutely. A people that can defend itself. Okay.
So are you saying the fascist state can't be nationalism? That's not nationalism?
No, I'm not saying that at all.
Well, you put consent to the government.
What, you think Hitler didn't have the consent of the government?
There are others that don't.
True, but...
Stalin was an equal.
Well, he had the consent of a lot of people. He killed a lot of people, but he had the consent of a lot of other ones. We don't... I mean, so... I think you're right to raise the issue of what makes a government illegitimate, but we liked as Democrats with a small d, we like to think anything that is non-democratic is by definition illegitimate because it doesn't secure the consent of the governed, when you could argue that's not true at all because you might be operating in a political culture where people are very happy based upon authoritarian traditions to be governed by Mao Zedong or Stalin or whomever. So that's where it gets tricky. Right, consent is consent. We think of consent as a plebiscite, you know, blah, blah, blah.
But you could also, but even within the latter, you know, there are, you know, much more benign forms of that and much more malevolent.
Absolutely. No, for sure.
I imagine that.
No, absolutely right. Yeah. Did I miss somebody before I get to Nancy? Yeah, okay, go ahead.
So all of these are kind of like, not positive,
They're just things.
They're just things.
Yeah.
But what you need for naturalism is you need like an other. You need to be different from something, or you're not.
All right. Well, so that now it's
not
right.
Just the active things you are, it's the...
Right.
You're different.
Okay, so that's getting much sexier now, much edgier, because it isn't just about a bunch of internal things, it's maybe about some sense of, and there was a very famous German conservative thinker who basically said what you just said, Carl Schmitt, it says, you know, politics is really inherently violent and it is about opposition. He had a huge, you know, he's sort of a proto-Nazi thinker, and then he became a Nazi jurist, you know, post-33, and these guys were extremely influenced by this very kind of social Darwinian view that says, yeah, politics is about the enemies you make, and like you should embrace that very violent aspect of what it means to be a human being, which is that people fight with each other. And nations fight, and you sort of make yourself through the struggle. And you have to kind of embrace that as a kind of an organic truth, and you also therefore have to accept the premise that, you know what, you may go into that room, that closed steel cage, and come out with a trophy. On the other hand, you might not.
I wasn't going there. I was just saying
that. No, but that is the logical outcome of othering, which is once you get into conflict, by definition, you're open to the possibility that you may be the one who ends up not holding the trophy. And those of you who've spent any time sort of listening to Hitler's rhetoric, he talked about that constantly. Like, hey, either we're going to win, or we're going to tear this thing down and, you know, sort of go crashing to defeat, et cetera, et cetera. Like, he got the fact that that was the flip side of the this insane dream he had of world conquest. So that's just a logical sort of pushing out to its most radical boundary, this idea that says life is about othering and it's about conflict. And you sort of, you know, take it as it comes kind of thing. Dan, did you have a comment?
So other really is boundaries or borders of some sort, some of the times physical and sometimes other,
yeah,
to know which side you're on, what's in and what's out.
Yeah.
The other one is myths, and which is different than history, myths and
great.
Those, I don't know what you call them, the shared beliefs and
stories.
Stories.
Absolutely.
Two words I was thinking.
Yeah, folklore, etc. Yeah, great. Did I miss anybody else? Maureen, did you want to go around one more time?
Well, just to talk a little bit more about the other.
Yeah.
Sometimes having the other pushes the nations together.
Yeah.
It pushes the nation together. By having an opponent,
sure,
that forces...
Right, that's what I was saying about Schmidt. Like, he was a great believer in that. Like, he understood that there was a kind of an intrinsic piece of that, but also an instrumental value to that, too, for sure. Well, when you look at all, I mean, I'm sorry that it's so, you know, orthographically scattered here, but when you look at these things, you realize that a bunch of these things are sort of, as Nancy, I think, was saying, they're just sort of things. Like, they are objective material things, like people make governments, they make economies, they built them. And those things sort of create these structures. That's one piece of this, like the social institutional side. But then a whole bunch of other things that people mention are cultural things. They're sort of meaning things. Dan talked about stories. Other people talked about values. Wendy talked about aspirational stuff, like a kind of a vision of what the purpose of this peoplehood thing is. So you've got objective things like geography, territory, institution stuff. But then you've got a lot of sort of stuff in your head about who you really are and why it really matters. Culture, history, story, aspiration, right? And I think you see in that kind of mix the complicated nature of nationalism. Because on the one hand, nationalism could be an idea that grows out of a certain kind of philosophical sense of things like the consent of the governed, to use, again, sort of Lockean American language. And, you know, if you think about, for example, the American nation or the American notion of nationalism, what is the nation in population terms that this state is built to, comes to serve? Is there a pre-existing nation? Yeah. No. It's whoever shows up. That's the whole immigration narrative thing. Right? Most people who look at nationalism, certainly in the European context, they say, you know, that nationalism sort of produces the nation, meaning that these entities, these new states, are literally made up. Right? Certain segments of society join movements. They're literate by definition. They can write down these stories that you were kind of picking up on. They can write books. They can write newspapers. They can campaign. They can create stories around all this stuff. They can organize people. They can eventually drill this down into the masses and change people's sense of identity. These aren't organic things. These are made up things. Right? Nationalism is a movement usually of elites. I mean, not super high elite. By the way, why does super high elite typically not join nationalism right from the start?
Not their benefit.
Not in their benefit. They're already entrenched. Like a guy who owns a, you know, 20,000 acre estate in East Prussia, like what does he care about German nationalism? He's already rich. He's already got a tremendous amount of social status based upon this kind of medieval feudal thing. He doesn't need nationalism to enhance his status. The people who typically care about it are lower middle class, teachers, journalists, civil servants, literate people who can do this. Yeah, Dan?
There's an issue with this, because if you're setting these things up, some of these things fit with a religion.
Yeah.
So if you appropriate them from a religion, it has issues.
Right.
Especially the myths, certain stories about, you know, certain and boundaries.
Absolutely.
Then that got into the race thing, sort of.
Absolutely. That's a huge insight. When you really, and again, Wendy was, we were sort of, before a lot of people came, we were sort of toggling back and forth between Hess and sort of 1930 stuff. I mean, think about a lot of the things that we associate with nationalism. It is a church. There's pageantry, there's music, there's parades, there's colors, there's drama, there's story, there are high priests. Right? There's a whole way in which nationalism is a kind of a modern church. And most importantly, which goes back to the othering thing, there is a very strong sense, both in terms of the aspirational, like this kind of like neo-messianic piece, like there's a futurology piece. And there is a sense of in-group, out-group. And again, that can, depending upon the nature of it, can be very violent or not. But yeah, there are a lot of ways in which there is a kind of a spiritual quality to it, for sure.
If it appropriates one particular religion, that, as opposed to making it secular,
yes,
to the nation.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's true too, right? That oftentimes the two kind of map onto each other in some way, but that may be just a kind of a strategic alliance, right? As opposed to a really a truly organic thing. Yeah, Wendy.
How much of nationalism is driven by economic factors? I'm thinking what you just said about rich Prussians and juxtaposing that today with the EU, where you're seeing a significant decline of nationalism through,
right,
economic forces.
Well, I think in the 19th century, a lot of it is driven by money. They were trying to open up the economy, and they saw nationalism as a means of doing that. And by the way, the American version of that, again, we talked a little bit about this a couple weeks ago, in terms of the updating of the Hamilton v. Jefferson battle about stuff like the bank, this is a part of Jacksonian rhetoric, right? Jacksonian, you know, Andrew Jackson says, you know, the problem with the bank is that it is this Whiggish institution that really is only for the rich merchants. And, you know, nationalism, by definition, ought to be about really empowering the middle class. And that's why, I mean, you could fault him in terms of his grasp of political economics, but he's saying that's why we've got to destroy the bank, because the bank is the tool of entrenched corporate interests. That's just the American version of this larger conversation. So yeah, economics is a huge piece of this. Yeah.
Inherent in nationalism is also prejudice.
Well, that is the great question, which is nationalism inherently ugly by our sort of moral standards? That it always ends up being about the other. And it's very tribal as opposed to philosophical. This is the great divide. I wrote it down here somewhere, which is nationalism either number one, revolutionary, class democratic, right? In other words, creating a body that just says, we want to self-govern, we want not to be governed by the Austro-Hungarian Empire or the British Empire or whomever. And there's nothing inherently othering about it, just that, you know, we want to govern ourselves as a community of people who accept a certain set of ideas, sort of political values, etc. Or is a state nationalist in the older cultural, linguistic, blood, common storyline way. That is the great fault line that runs through the history of politics, really, in effect, in the last 250 years, which is countries like the United States that are fundamentally liberal, and they have very, even though they also, in some ways, I think for other reasons, but they also internalize othering pieces to that. But still in all, you know, they tend to adopt the view that you know, we have a very simple notion of the state, which is this Lockean one that says the state is just about serving the needs of the individual, the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness language of the Constitution and the like. And it's not about the needs of some kind of primordial group with a story. But that's the minority, right? Most nationalisms go from the liberal, like, let's open up the economy view of things, to, no, let's talk about stuff like where we come from. So from the Germans, obviously the most infamous case, you know, these myths of these, of coming from the Black Forest, these early German fables, they're doing cultural stuff, they eventually, of course, post-Darwin, right, post-1859, will begin getting involved in this sort of crazy pseudoscientific racialism stuff. They're not the only ones who are doing that, but obviously they are by far the most infamous at it. So they get into sort of pseudoscience, or they're doing race, they're doing pseudoscience, they're doing culture, they're doing language, they're doing history, and of course ultimately blood, that's the most pernicious thing of all. And of course the problem with all that is what? It's not just that it's very much sort of contrapuntal in terms of saying, you know, we're kind of at one point and then at the other point there's everybody else. But how much permeability is there in the groupiness of the group once you've set it up that way? Very little. How come?
How come?
I mean, what is it about the nature of those things that would lead you to say that? I mean, I think you're exactly right. There's very little permeability here. How come?
Well, even if you look at the United States, I mean, what we did to the Irish, what we did to the other people, I mean, just, you know.
But again, the United States doesn't, I mean, the United States at various points, we're seeing another point right now, arguably for some people anyway, there's a long, very complicated history around naturalization in this country. That for sure is true in terms of immigration and immigrants and the like. Why is this nationalist, ethnic, historical, linguistic, cultural, racial, why is that so mischievous in moral and political terms? In terms of the lack of permeability. I mean, what fundamentally, I mean, I think you were trying to get us there, but, yeah, Ken?
You can convert to Judaism, but can you convert to being German?
Yeah, well, that's, right, so that's it. You can't really, if you're saying it's about history, blood, I mean, blood is obviously by far the biggest game changer here, the pseudoscientific piece. You can't convert into this thing. And this is the language that we recognize. And by the way, not just Germany. You know, the Yale series, Jewish Lives, that series of nice little biographies, my friend Yehuda Mirsky's biography, Rob Cook is in there, Hill Halkin's biography, Jabotinsky. There's a biography of Leon Blum, the first Jewish prime minister, or premier, if I always forget, I don't think they're prime ministers, of France. Blum is a socialist and a Jew who comes into office in the, I forget what year, in the 1930s, not so important, but the day he takes office, a right-wing Catholic sort of neo-monarchist politician stands up in the National Assembly and says, speaking of illegitimacy, he says, I don't acknowledge your right to be the premier of France, of our country, of our republic. How come? He says, you're not even French. You're a Jew. So that's it. That's radical impermeability, right? That's what you were picking up on. And I think it grows out of, you know, this sense that says, yeah, ultimately nationalism on some material level is about stuff like geography and institutions and territory and blah, 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 all this materialist stuff. But the real juice of the thing is the cultural meaning stuff. Story, history, language, that much deeper sense of tribalism. And yeah, that's really designed to be, I think, you know, the French term, you know, chauvinistic. Chauvinistic has a very strong pejorative cast to it, right? That there's something kind of emotional about it, irrational, and very much oriented towards passion around the other. And that's really what I think we tend to be very sensitive to, especially, you know, it's funny that you brought up the Irish, because, yeah, the Irish suffered terribly here in many ways, but if you ask them, you know, compare this to their life in the United Kingdom, right, they would have taken this any day of the week. So, you know, this is the greatness of America, because America is not a nation state. And I think that makes all the difference. Questions or comments so far? I mean, is this clear to people? How does this play out for Jews? So the emergence, again, and by the way, just to map this onto some more sort of specific historical points, a lot of this rises and falls with Napoleon, meaning Napoleon, the French Revolution, right? The core values of the French Revolution was liberty, equality, and fraternity. And the French Revolution was, I think, in some ways, deeply universalistic. And so when Napoleon conquers pretty much all of Europe, all the way up to Moscow, if you remember your Tolstoy, all the way up to Moscow, before he then kind of realizes he doesn't have any L.L. Bean long underwear and he'd have to get the hell out of there in the wintertime. So, you know, the point is, his view is, hey, you know what, we are bringing the principles of the French Revolution all over Europe. And that's good for the Jews, because in place after place, they go, and the Jewish communities of that community are emancipated, they become citizens and the like. The problem, of course, is that he loses. He retreats, I mean, he literally loses, he retreats, he has to pull back from Moscow. And what happens in the wake of his, and kind of, you know, the waxing and waning of his empire, is that counter-nationalism spring up as a kind of a anti-French response. And these communities, most famously in Germany, but other places too, they, in effect, develop this much more romantic sense of nationalism as being about our unique sense of what it means to be a German. And that's a huge piece of this, because if you think about the French and American revolutions, they are heavily oriented towards universal truths, enlightenment kinds of language. What you see in response to these universalistic appeals is the contrary, which is, no, let's go super particularistic. Let's talk about what ties us together as a small, intimate group and non-French. Let's emphasize our Germanness, our Italianness, our Austrianness, our Czechness, whatever it is. Is that much more emotionally satisfying than sort of talking about universalistic things? Typically, yes. Because part of the, I think, the real appeal of nationalism goes to the psychic need to say, I'm in the in-group and you're not. And that's what this more reactionary romantic nationalism does. It's about feeling, not thought. It's about intimacy. It's about pride. It's about pastness. It's about shared stories. And maybe that, and trending towards the chauvinistic, I'm better than you, right? Like my Wiener Schnitzel is better than your, you know, aglio and olio kind of thing, like whatever those ridiculous arguments are about. And so you get a lot of battling. And through the battling, the sense of differentness is really heightened. Is that good for the Jews? How is it bad, Peter?
Well, they're not, just take an economic term, they're separate, but they're not.
Right, although, so on the one hand, they're integrating, and yet every step of the way, they're running into arguably cultural barriers.
They don't get a seat at the table.
Right.
The way I read it.
But how is it ultimately good for the Jews?
Well, as a group, I think they're starting to understand that they have a group.
Okay, so ironically or not, it reinforces Jewish groupiness. And that will be a big piece of the kind of pre-story of these precursor guys, which is realizing, hey, you know what? What's the learning I take from nationalism? We're a nation too.
Is this the only example of a nationalistic movement without geographic consequences?
Well, that's what makes it so interesting, right? All these other folks are sort of sitting there, right? They are in situ. The Jews are like, you know, they're in Russia. They're in Zagreb. They're all over the place. And yet they're having this kind of crazy conversation about their groupiness. So what does that really mean? I mean, is that sort of like a non-starter? Is that totally ridiculous? For sure, on the logistical level, it makes it infinitely more complicated, right? When Byron, you know, that famous painting, Byron goes to, you know, sort of aid the Greek patriots in their attempt to, you know, fight for Greek nationalism. The point is, they're already there. It's not like they're 3,000 miles from Greece kind of thing.
But aren't they considered citizens there, too, because they were born German or they were born Polish?
Well, they are, but part of the drama of 19th century Jewish life in Europe is this kind of constant anxiety about whether or not their citizenship, their emancipation will be revoked. In other words, there's this kind of contingent quality. Again, to use American language, it's as if in the wake of, and of course this sort of happened, right? The Congress passes Amendments 13, 14, and 15, which do what? The Civil War Amendments, what do? They basically free the slaves and other stuff kind of attendant therein. Lincoln is assassinated, right? He's succeeded by his vice president, who's not even a Republican, and a racist, Andrew Johnson. So what are the freedmen rightly concerned with? What's going to happen? Yeah, they're going to be re-enslaved. There's going to be some kind of dramatic, you know, kind of regression from the power of the war and the power of you know, emancipationist ideology and rhetoric and legal action. And that, of course, is exactly what happened. I mean, it sort of happened, you know, there were more stages after. But the point is, the idea that says, oh, we passed a law, you know, the Voting Rights Act. Well, the Voting Rights Act meant one thing to, you know, Chief Justice Warren. It means something very different to Chief Justice Roberts. That's what happens in countries. So the idea that says, well, you know, just because Napoleon came and changed the game, it means it can never go back, au contraire. So Jews are super anxious about this whole question of, you know, is there citizenship? Is this whole kind of new political identity, is it going to hold, or is it going to become kind of buffeted by these much more romantic, in-groupy nationalisms? And that's a part of the psychic karma of Jewish communities all over Europe, really through the 19th century. And of course, one of the things that will produce is this, what Zionists later will debunk, is this kind of pathetic, craven, self-hating, like, I want to be more goyish than the goyim. Because that's the only way, psychically and otherwise, I can prove to my senior partner, like, I got to eat more shrimp cocktail at the holiday party than him. Because if I don't do that, he's going to be saying the whole time, you know, he's a Jew, like, I can't imagine making this guy a partner. So that becomes a kind of a part of the psychic and sort of spiritual and, you know, material way that Jews have of kind of expressing their anxiety about trying to fit into this emerging nationalist world. Nancy, you were super patient, I apologize.
No, that's okay. But what I'm not getting about nationalism, and maybe I never got it, is that except for the fact that people were literate and people could write letters and people could travel, people
been tribal back to the Bible.
Right.
I mean, every one of those types of languages.
So what's different?
That's my question.
Okay.
That's
what what's different about nationalism as opposed to just the idea that says you always had groupy groups? You always had, you know, the Basque in a region of Spain. So how is this different? Like, how is the modern nation state different than, the guys wearing the funny caps in, region of Spain? How is it different?
Back to the Bible. I mean,
yeah. No, absolutely. You could argue that the notion of groupiness is just a function of human nature. It's just like an organic thing. People like to be with people like them. And that means that, yeah, we share in a region, a locality, we share a cuisine, we share a topography, we share a language, we share an economy. By definition, those are the people with whom we feel most greatest affinity. I mean, that makes total sense. Like, why would you even question that? So how is that different from a nation state? Because that's a great question. How is it different? What is the relationship of a nation state vis-a-vis these older regional/local kinds of organic
tribes?
Knittings, tribes? How is it different? Yeah?
Well,
Pam?
It goes back to what you said about the insecurity. I mean, you're not really in control. I mean, it's sort of what, the opposite of what the Reformer said. They said, well, good, we'll just act like the Germans and we'll not do the Jewish stuff.
Well, I don't think she's... I don't think Nancy's asking about the Jewy piece. I think she's asking a more generic question. How is the nation state different than these older, more organic, just like, hey, you know what, we come from this tiny little region of Italy... And of course we feel connected to each other because we speak the same language, we eat the same food, third cousins marry each other, like we're completely bound up with each other. Yeah, Karen.
They feel they have more power.
How come?
Because there's more of them.
How come more? What are we talking about? You skipped a step, but you're absolutely right. More of them, how come? Was it in a state and like a locality? It's okay. Meaning, what have they succeeded in doing?
Collectively, they've formed a government.
Okay, good. In other words, the crucial missing link is, and this is where you get into this notion of the nation state as an invented thing. An elite has figured out how to make a set of political moves that enabled it to build a bigger state, right? We've made Italy, again, those of you who remember your European history, Italy becomes unified in the 1850s, early 1860s. How many little principalities had been there before?
A lot.
So what was the Roman Empire?
Well, what was the Roman Empire? Right. They weren't trying to make big states. They, by definition, sort of wanted not to have that. They were very happy to have like the Lombards doing. I mean, the point is they wanted people to be disunited so that they could. The only thing that knit them together was the imperium. The importance of the nation state precisely is the scale and scope of the thing. And by the way, that means. That's why the cultural piece becomes so important. Because is there anything actually organic that ties them together in these new states? Not so much. That's why you have to have people writing stories in places like national universities, studying the history of the German people, telling German tales from the Black Forest kind of stuff. The fact is, you had a bunch of Germanies. You had Bavaria. You had, all these tiny little places. Same thing in Italy, etc., etc. Balkans, kind of most famously. These states are made up. And they have to, somebody once said, we have made Italy, an Italian revolutionary said, we have made Italy, now we must make Italians. The Italians didn't precede this. They followed it. It's a set of political moves that produces a frame, and then they have to create the national culture following. By the way, relevant to... Excuse me?
If you go ask an Italian, they'll say, a real Italian will not say I'm Italian. They're Sicilian, they're Venetian, they're...
Absolutely. And by the way, the time of the French Revolution, also, you don't have an official French language. Like, there's a bunch of dialects that are floating around France. France is a big country, a lot of different regions. That's a process. That's a process of homogenization that requires literacy, it requires education, requires some version of centralized administration, institutions like the army. By the way, does the United States have any set of institutions that did some version of this?
The army.
What else?
Schools.
You know, my mother, may she rest in peace, little first-generation girl in Fitchburg. She doesn't know English when she walks into the kindergarten. She talks Yiddish at home with her parents. I mean, how integrated is she really into American life as a four-year-old compared to 2 years later when she's already been to first grade and she knows how to talk English? Yeah. The language piece is huge, crucial in this story, for sure. So it's absolutely, it's about scale and scope of the thing, and, you know, and that then gets you back to things like armies, being able to defend your borders and the like. But it's really, in many ways, it is a deeply inorganic notion, because these are made up political entities. They're not organic, and of course, so in other words, there's a lot of internal violence in this process, because what it really means is you're sort of taking a bulldozer to these older regional local traditions, again, depending upon, you know, the nature of what's going on, and saying, no, no, we don't want you to speak your weird little dialect, right? Because if we let you do that, we can't kind of get on top of you in terms of promoting a whole new identity that will knit us together. You know, so you got, and now, of course, in our time, you now have a kind of a pushback to that pushback. That's the thing, like in Catalonia and Spain, like you have these groups saying, ah, you know what, we've had enough of this kind of, you know, centripetal, like all everything going towards the center kind of thing, and we want to embrace heterogeneity and the like, and, you know, that's part of the tension of this thing. By the way, does Israel do this? This notion of a kind of a constructed... Absolutely, you bet. My wife, over the years, has spent a lot of time in places like Yad L'Kashish, a wonderful place, a lifeline for the elderly, and you go into the different workshops, you see, you know, elderly Israeli citizens, and, for example, if you go into the beading workshop, the women were sitting in that beading room. Where do they get these beading traditions from? Where they came from? You know, Uzbekistan and Samarkand and, you know, Bukhara, this and that, the other thing. Yeah, what, you think their grandchildren are going to keep beating like them? Their grandchildren are listening to Chava Halberstein and Dov Nachash and, you know, whatever, you know, reading Edgar Cayce. Like, they're Israelis. They're not Bukharan Jews anymore so much. So this is a part of what states feel they've got to do, which is to sort of, you know, crack some eggs to make the omelet kind of thing. They gotta figure out how to homogenize people. So there's something very inorganic about this and kind of violent about it. And that's part of the energy of the thing. Jonathan.
It was helping me. I don't know European history very well, but I was sort of forgot what I learned so far. But I know that France probably happened around the early part of the 19th century with the French Revolution.
1791 and following. A bunch of their little mini chapters, but yeah.
So France happened
like 89.
Beginning of the 19th century, and then Italy said 1860. But
Well, that's not a revolution. That's a unification problem.
But then I know Russia didn't happen until, you know, the early
1917. Yeah, good.
So but I don't know about all the Balkans. I don't know much about Spain. I don't know much about the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It's awful that all mixed up together with me. So we could have some history so we'd understand what this all this nationalism is.
Well, I mean, the short version, first of all, that was a great rendition of Sam Cooke's song, I Don't Know Much About History, one of my favorite songs. I think the meta message that you're asking really about is this is a trend that really sweeps Europe, different times, different places, but the point is there is something very compelling about the general idea, at least ostensibly, of self-determination, right? People want to govern themselves. That's kind of the big takeaway. The problem is that the units that ultimately kind of spring up politically, in fact, arguably, are not necessarily about self-determination because they've already made a huge move towards this consolidation of communities. And so people may feel like, hey, you know what, I thought I was signing on to a thing that was really going to represent me, when in fact what I really see is that there is a strong, and this is the most famous example of this, maybe is the German unification. You know, by far the most powerful German state that ends up becoming the dominant player in the new German nation in 1871 is Prussia. Right? In other words, there are a bunch of little principalities that sort of go into this thing called the new Germany, the new Reich. But the point is that happens kind of everywhere, right? So, Dan.
So what I was hearing is that there are things where we're reducing friction and making greater friction. Boundaries is more absolute, but it's like having a common language makes it easier to talk among themselves, but harder to talk to somebody
yes.
outside. You know, it's adding, putting in frictions, and removing frictions of various sort, you're molding that.
Yeah.
Is what consciously was being done.
I think so. Yeah, I mean, if you're asking, yeah, I think that is true. I mean, I think that this is, but there's, I mean, the thing that I was sort of emphasizing was that the notion of internal friction is potentially always there as well. In other words, that these are societies that may be nicely knit together, ethnically, regionally, and otherwise, maybe not.
Also, it was close to when Israel happened enough that the knowledge of how this happened was used by the people who founded Israel.
Yes, although what's interesting about Israel, I mean, the one thing I would say about Israel, we will get to this much more next year than this year. I mean, 1948, Israel is overwhelmingly Ashkenazic at that point. So some of the things that we associate with kind of significant socioeconomic cleavage, like, you know, the Sephardim feel like, hey, you brought us here in the middle of the night, you dumped us in these shitty development towns, and, you know, you sort of treated us like second-class citizens, which for sure was true. That's really a post-48 story. So part of the sort of energy of the pre-state period, which we'll spend a lot of time talking about, is precisely that people did feel, in the grand scheme of things, like they were pretty tied together by virtue of a kind of a common ethnic story. The Sephardim, in many ways, were not tied to that story, and I think they paid a tremendous price for that. But the point is, they got the thing up and running with a minimum amount of friction. Yes, there was some stuff like, oh yeah, the German Jews sort of looked down on the Russian Jews and vice versa. But by and large, they had a sense of, oh, you know, we're all Ashkenazic, and sort of that was, I think that was significant. Who did I miss here? Ben.
I just say that when you think about it, though, I mean, in terms of Jewish nation building, it's kind of like, in the beginning, like negative nation building, because it's really saying, well, we can't be German.
Yes.
You know, so you're really going on negative energy here.
Yes.
Because we can't belong.
Well, Jews love negative energy. They see it as an opportunity. I mean, and that's actually very generative. And I'm not being facetious in it. I mean, I think the real question is how do you take what is a negative experience, of which we have many in life, and how do you figure out the opportunity that's sort of embedded in the thing, that if you're just constantly focused on how pissed off you are, you're going to miss that. I am you know, committed to sort of embracing my pissed offness, so I sometimes miss those opportunities, but that is a huge part of the sort of the psychic drama of Zionism, which is people who are trying to figure out, who are trying to do exactly what Ben just asked about, which is, okay, where is our opportunity in this story of a nationalism that is becoming increasingly xenophobic, increasingly narrow, increasingly about othering, increasingly a little bit wacky in terms of some of this cultural tribal stuff? Where does our opportunity lie? Most Jews, of course, will not see the opportunity as emerging as a, in effect, a counter-nationalism. And part of the particular energy of Zionism will always be this sort of very frantic sense of, you know, hey, how come nobody else sees what we think is so obviously, patently true, which is that the only real moral of the story is everybody else is orienting themselves around self-determination, et cetera, et cetera. We've got to do exactly the same. Like, that's what the game is. There's no other game here. The game is self-determination. And the question is, are you going to be playing in that game? As opposed to trying to make partner, trying to do this, trying to do that, trying to argue, having these stupid arguments between, you know, Benji and Wes and Eric Burvis about, like, you know, should your synagogue be kosher or not. This nationalist argument is like, who cares about that stuff? That is so not what the argument is. The argument is about self-determination. So that's a part of the energy. Exactly right. Yeah, Nancy.
So this is a perfect segue into alkali.
Yeah, good.
One of my questions is that at the beginning of the reading, his view of Zionism wasn't initially about security. He saw the creation of colonies in the Holy Land as a necessary preamble to redemption, which I had never heard before, which
good.
Was very evangelical, and it wasn't until the 1840s in the blood libel in Damascus that he said, well, we need it for security.
Right.
So my question is, except for the security argument, was this an argument? Because I had never
right.
heard that except in the Christian evangelical world.
Good.
We have to go populate that area, nothing to do with
right.
security, but we want to bring about redemption.
Right. So, yeah, fair enough. So, alkali. First of all, let's do a little bit of bio of him. Where is he from?
Sarajevo.
Okay, so he's kind of a little bit of a fringe figure in the sense of he's not really sort of in the heartland of Jewish life. He's not from a place like Poland. What's interesting about Sarajevo, that and by the way, when you use Hertzberg, this book is wonderful in many ways, not the least of which is Professor Hertzberg gives you a nice little, you know, kind of précis of each person, so you should sort of cheat, aggressively cheat, and make sure that you look at that verse, because it'll kind of help you along as you sort of enter into these people's minds. So I'm just looking for alkali now. 1798 to 1878. Has a nice long life. He's born in 1798 in Sarajevo. Lived in Jerusalem. He serves as a rabbi in the capital of Serbia. What's significant about that? I mean, Hertzberg goes on to say, what does he see in the Balkans? I mentioned Byron and the Greeks a few minutes ago. Yeah?
Serbia has three major religions, at least two major religions.
Okay, so number one, right. So it's kind of an interesting place in terms of religious diversity and ethnic diversity, too. That's absolutely right. But what else is going on in that period? I mean, he's sort of a young man, kind of, you know, he's got his sort of political learning curve here. He's not just, you know, studying Talmud and rabbinating all day long. What's he seeing? Okay.
That was my reading of it, was that was what really set him on with the blood libel in Damascus.
Yes, although what's in, yes, he, this is what Hertzberg says. But even, what's interesting is, assuming that Hertzberg is correct, he sees as early as the 1820s that, in fact, European life politically is very much about this kind of increasing set of contests between these different groups. The Turks, the Greeks, somebody mentioned the Balkans and the like. And, you know, the point is national freedom is becoming a thing in public life. It's becoming a conversation point. So he sees that, point number one. Point number two is that even prior to the blood libel thing, the Damascus thing, he's already in the 1830s, he's already writing about redemption. Now, what's interesting about that? I mean, he doesn't spend a lot of time talking about that, and his essay is post-Damascus. But what does it already suggest about this guy that would suggest, you know, he's a little bit of an outlier from the get-go in terms of his whole notion of redemption?
Well, he says it's going to be the gradual return supported by the diaspora, that it's not going to be a divine intervention,
okay,
that men are going to...
And what's significant about that?
It goes against...
the idea of the Messiah.
Okay, good. It goes against, remember we looked at that Talmudic story that said, no, redemption has got to be about Mashiach. It's got to be about passivity. You've got to hang in there. The whole point of the Jeremiad prophecy that went all the way back to the destruction of the first temple in the 6th century before the Common Era was that you are in exile for a reason. That reason may be somewhat inscrutable to you, but God knows it. And you've got to just kind of suck it up and take it on faith and sort of internalize this stance of political passivity. And you therefore have to, in effect, have this view of human history as something that in some ways is quite static and that is sort of waiting for this dramatic messianic era about which you know basically nothing. You know, you can speculate and, you know, it's your dime, so you can say whatever you want about it, but the bottom line is you don't really know what that's going to look like. Yeah, Peter?
But he said, I think he's not looking at Israel as, boom, it's a messianic. He's saying, he said some things in there that begin it modestly. He used the situation where he says, well, pay rent.
Yeah.
This is not
right,
a messianic thing. This is a more practical,
yeah,
economic,
right,
you know, grow this place.
Right. So in other words, how religious is this guy? Right? That's what's your take on this? I mean, in what way is he religious, like with a capital R, talking about Mashiach on the one hand? On the other hand, is he kind of a modern-sounding, pragmatic, like, yeah, we got to go there, and dribs and drabs, build colonies, etc., etc.? What's that kind of titration look like for him? Yeah?
He clearly is familiar with the prophets, because he says that, you know, Hebrew is going to be the common language,
yeah, yeah,
because of the prophecy of Joel, so he's still trying to tie it back.
Absolutely.
To...
No, no, he knows the secret handshake for sure. Like, he's like a Jewy Jew. He went to Hebrew school. Absolutely. Yeah. No, no, he's talking in the Jewish language of, he's giving, first of all, a lot of this stuff reads like a Dvar Torah. A Dvar Torah. He's like a Torah talk. Like, he is, you know, he'll say something and then he'll kind of back it up with a proof text from the Bible. Like, that's what rabbis do. Yeah.
Well, and I got the feeling in reading what he said was that, yes, he had the knowledge, but his philosophy was, it's up to the people to,
okay,
do it. And he's using this because he knew his audience, and he was saying, you know, like you learned, it says it in the scripture, and it was just,
right,
like Abraham bought, you know, the...
Good.
...the cave, and we need to buy it too, so we've got...
Okay, fabulous. So in other words, right, so he's not talking to himself, like this is not happening in a soundproof room kind of thing. He is, you get the feeling that this is a talk he could be giving to people in the synagogue on a Shabbat morning kind of thing. And so there is a Jewish religious kind of valence to it. Lots of Jewish symbols, like quoting from the Hebrew Bible and the like. Jewish aspiration, you know, when he talked about aspirational stuff like talking about deliverance, Mashiach, blah, blah, blah. And yet, the tools, in many ways, are super modern. Now, I mean, not highly technocratic the way you'll get later on, but it's got to be people. It's got to be about settlement. It's got to be about contemporary senses of what it means to kind of organize and reorganize yourself. And that's what makes these early, what Hertzberg called, he called them precursors, that's what makes them interesting. In some ways, ultimately sort of limited. The fact that they are, in many ways, profoundly religious and pretty conventional in their sense of what they're ultimately doing, which is trying, maybe, to bring about messianic redemption. On the other hand, the actual tools suggest that they are willing to advocate techniques, solutions, that most of their, in this case, rabbinic colleagues, are not doing. And that's the blending is kind of funky. I mean, also, you know, ultimately, when you sort of impose the means test on them, you know, how successful are they? Right? I mentioned in response to what Pam said, well, but he's clearly talking to real Jews. He's a rabbi. He had people, you know, who listened to him, whatever that means. But did these guys build a mass movement? No. You know, that this is sort of 1.0. Right, this is sort of like Wayne's World, like three guys playing the guitar in Wayne's mom's basement kind of deal. So there is a way in which they're sort of talking to themselves and their, you know, 25 parishioners. They don't really know how to blow this thing up and go much bigger. And yet there is the beginning of a sense of, yeah, but this is kind of what it's got to be. I mean, they want to get bigger. They want to be successful. They're not embracing failure by any means, but this is early. You're not talking about a movement at this point in any real organizational sense. And in that sense, Hertzberg is right to call them precursors, although, of course, precursor, those of you who are very good at English will know this. In what way is the term precursor problematic? What does precursor mean? Someone is a precursor of something?
Coming before.
So you already have to know what happened.
Yeah. And historically, is that a huge no-no in terms of the way historians are supposed to operate? Right. So this is, right. So my teacher, who, you know, liked to say that Hertzberg was wrong in doing this because he sort of creates the implication that these guys were going to know what happened after them in some sort of anticipatory way. And there's no evidence that that's true. I mean, I think what makes these guys interesting is precisely that they had no idea what was going to happen, but they were sort of, in their own way, trying to strike out, learn from these nationalist episodes around them, say, let's embrace some significant degree of human activity. They didn't really have a program for making that happen, but the point is they are trying to sort of move the needle in terms of humanistic, you know, sort of quasi-political activity. And that's interesting and important. I missed somebody here. Yeah, Ken.
There seems to be a disconnect, like, in that living in the 1820s, seeing wars of independence.
Yeah.
Violent. And yet he's talking about we're going to rent some land, we're going to buy some land, you know, we'll work a little bit. So it's a different kind of nationalistic... Yeah, a different kind of nationalist. So... Is it realistic that could be, that ever's going to happen? Or is he thinking that we're destined to be there and this is how we're going to get there?
Right.
And it's different.
Or is that just like a cowardly, you know, craven avoidance of, hey, you know what, blood? It's about blood and fire kind of thing.
Which is the end of...
Yeah, well, I mean, look, I think that's actually, I think he's, I'm not sure if he's at Harvard already or not, but Derek Penslaw wrote a book about Jews in the military, in which this is one of the issues. I mean, the Jews really embrace, you know, how was it the Jews came to realize that Zionism was not just going to be about social stuff and about political stuff and about cultural stuff, but there was going to have to be a significant military piece too, because this was how nations are born. I mean, they sort of birth themselves through conflict, including physical. So it's. I think it's great that you picked up on that. It's not clear that he gets that at all, even though ironically it's kind of right happening right next door. So should we take a look at a few verses of, we'll treat it like the Bible. The third redemption. What are the first two, by the way? What are the first two redemptions?
The temples.
The first two temples. So already, what's he doing? Even just in terms of the kind of the nomenclature of the title. What's he doing? Yeah. Very nice, you know, Jewish message. Saying, hey, all I'm doing is, I'm not talking about something, anything radical. I'm talking about, he's phrasing it as in, I'm just sort of pushing Jewish history along. The third redemption. Excuse me. Would somebody like to read? It's written in the Bible. Any takers? No guts, no glory. Wendy, thank you, dear.
It is written in the Bible, return, O Lord, as to the tens and thousands of the families of Israel. On this verse, the rabbis commented in the Talmud as follows. It proves that the divine presence can be felt only if there are at least 2,000 and 2,000 of Israelites together. Yet we pray every day, let our eyes behold thy return and mercy unto Zion. Upon whom should the divine presence rest? Of sticks and stones. Therefore, as the first step in the redemption of our souls, we must cause at least 22,000 to return to the Holy Land. This is the necessary preparation for a descent of the divine presence among us. Afterwards, he will grant to us and all of Israel further signs of his favor.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so that numerology, totally transparent, like you totally got that, comes from the text. I mean, what's going on there? We got some math people here. What is this work? I mean, what's he doing here? Tens and thousands of the families of Israel, and from this you derive what? Huh? A critical mass, although his whole kind of playing with the numbers, what would you chalk that up to, Ed? Yeah, totally arbitrary. It's a midrash. He's doing what any darshan does. He's doing what any exegete does. He's got an argument he wants to make that says, look, the point of this thing, it can't be five guys. Right? It can't be five guys who made a bake sale in their little town somewhere in Poland and they got enough money to buy five steamship tickets. It's got to be a critical mass, whatever that means. Right, but fundamentally, he's giving a Devar Torah here. He's writing, he's giving a Midrash. And then he goes on to say, what? I mean, that in that sort of big paragraph towards the bottom, he says, well, what's the difference between the first and second redemptions and the third? Unfortunately, which makes our sense of burden much greater, yeah?
Everyone came in and God had made everything perfect and it was all ready for them. And now, it's not perfect and everyone's spread across the world, so people will come in drips and drabs. It's not going to be
right.
All.
He's preparing everyone for what, of course, was true, which was, you know what? We are dispersed. We are weaker. The land is desolate. It's going to be very difficult. No catering by Andrew there when we show up. Like, we're not going to, this is not what's going to happen.
Well, he's clear that the diaspora is going to have to support it.
Absolutely. And is that true?
Yeah.
Yeah. All the capacity is going to, in some ways, come from the outside. You're going to have to sort of build it as you go. It's not there. And by the way, that will later on become a big part of the anti-imperialist piece of saying, you know, that we are so much better than the Ottomans or the Arabs themselves, which is these people haven't even built any infrastructure in the place. But he's not even looking at that. He's just saying, you know, yes, this will be a much harder redemption.
So did they know at the time, because people had, like, visited and come back, that the land was so desolate that there weren't...
Yeah. They had some, I mean, if you're asking, were there lots of organized missions? The argument was no.
Yeah. But people had gone and said,
yeah, I mean, there was also, I mean, some of you may know this, somebody mentioned European history before. You know, there's a tradition throughout the 19th century of Europeans traveling to the Holy Land, you know, for religious reasons, for, you know, archaeological reasons, what have you, bringing back, you know, artifacts and the like, stealing stuff, obviously, that's the classic European way, right? Your great museums of the world are filled with these things. Europeans had some sense of kind of what these places looked like. You had a kind of a flourishing kind of lithographic universe of people making prints of the Holy Land and stuff like that. Of course, by his time, almost, I forget when, I mean, again, by the American Civil War, you got Matthew Braid, like people are taking pictures already by the middle of the 19th century. So you've got actual pictures of the Holy Land. So yeah, people have some sense of what this place looks like. And what kind of characterizes it in terms of capacity and stuff like that. So, yeah, they're not really, I mean, you could kind of say, well, they're very dismissive of the inhabitants and this and that. But the point is, there is some awareness of what is going on. What else about alkali? Anything else? Besides this notion of the three redemptions?
Hebrew. He mentions that they're going to have to resurrect Hebrew.
Okay. The Holy Tongue, yeah. What else? Yeah, Pam?
He also talks about you have to organize, like, it's almost like the precursor, if you want to use the word, the Jewish nations did. They had to organize outside first, and then
right.
It was like some kind of organization.
Some version of, like, an organization that will, you know, sort of sit on top of this thing, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. What else? Anything else that struck you about this? What does he say about this? I mean, what's his... Yeah?
Because his sultan would just be happy to give it back.
Yeah. Like, interesting, huh?
Wouldn't care.
Wouldn't care? Why not?
It's ours. We're supposed to have it. So they'll be okay.
Well, that's... Yeah. But also, again, maybe the idea that when we get there, we'll actually do a lot of good things, and in this kind of classic imperial way, he'll be happy for that. Of course, that suggests, by the way, that his ultimate political view is what? I mean, his ultimate view of a political goal is what? Is it kind of radical self-government, completely cut away from the Sultan? Not clear.
He says
Pamrat.
Pamrat, and they can believe and worship as they want to, and
okay.
Worship as
so, in other words, this is a world still. This is way before kind of the most radical, World War I era. Like President Wilson's notion of self-determination, post-colonial, anti-colonial. These guys are not that radical. They're sort of assuming, if anything, the opposite, which is the thing that will enable Jewish settlement to occur, will be the extent to which the imperial regime will enable it to happen. So, in many ways, these things are not anti-imperial at all. Their view is, the world is basically organized imperium by imperium, empire by empire. Your strategy has to be figure out the best empire to make an alliance with, and then to get territory inside of that empire. Right? And then at that point it becomes a kind of a strategic game, which is maybe the czars are the best partners. Maybe the Kaiser. Maybe the Emperor of Austria, Austro, the Hungarian Empire. Maybe the Ottoman. Maybe the Sultan. Unclear. I mean, different people argue differently about that. Herzl will also play this game too. Hey, I'll call on the Sultan. I'll call on the Kaiser. I'll call on the Queen. Kind of thing. Not clear. And what are some of the vindications of that strategy? the idea that says, you know, this will happen because of your ability to make a kind of like a neo-medieval royal alliance with an empire. What are some of the pieces that would suggest, in fact, that strategy was well worth pursuing? Number one, they're able to buy land. The Sultan lets them do that. He sort of is a little bit begrudging about it, but it doesn't stop. Right? So that's absolutely true. We'll get there in a week or so. The first Aliyah is, in fact, land purchases that are sort of, in effect, literally kind of happen under the nose of the Sultan. So that's piece of evidence number one that supports this claim. What's another piece of evidence that supports this? This idea that says, you know, ultimately, Zionism has got to be political in the sense of having a strategy for linking up with a larger political entity. What's another piece of evidence? How about the Uganda thing? Who's making that proffer? Who owns Uganda? And that, I mean, we'll get there in a few weeks, but it's a part of British East Africa. So that's piece of evidence number two that says absolutely, you know, make friends with the Brits. They got it, you know, they're by far the largest empire in the world. They're very happy to give you a few hundred thousand square miles of territory in East Africa. It's a freebie for them. What do they care? There's plenty more where that came from. It's like what any development officer has to learn the first day of working, which is, when a person gives you $1,000, it's not their last $1,000. Right? Ask for more. So the British have millions and millions of square miles of territory. How is it a big deal for them to you know, cut off a piece of East Africa and give it to you? They're happy to do it. The Balfour Declaration is another example. Right, so yeah, so this is a very interesting kind of proto-text in that regard, which says, yes, you know what, it's you have to cultivate the Sultan. What else about this text? Anything else that you picked up on? Right, very practical, railroads, organization, this and that. Is God present in this text? Sure he is. Right?
He's present, but he's not really going
yes.
to
help. He's not going to do much. Right. This is a post-biblical world where God is sort of absent, but you're constantly talking about him and invoking his name and hoping he'll show his favor. Again, it's a religious language, even though when you really peel away the layers, humans are doing all the work. Okay. Any other questions or comments about this one? All right. How about Kalischer? He's a little bit later. Where's he from?
Poland.
He's from Poland, Western Poland. Why is that interesting, by the way? Those are any got any Yekas here? Any German Jews? None? That's so sad. Gee whiz. He's from Poznan. Actually, any people here from Western Poland, your families? Most of us come from much farther east. This guy comes from Poznan, which is Western Poland, Eastern Prussia. What's interesting about that? Hertzberg says a little word about that. The fact that he's from a kind of a borderland. What's significant about that?
The board is always changing.
Right.
So it gives him a feeling of why national.
Exactly. He's very conscious of the fact that this is where you get the greatest degree of sort of friction, literally, because you have these highly contested spaces where people are, by definition, they're super conscious of national difference because, you know, boundaries are swapping all the time. In the case of between France and Germany, you know, that Alsace-Lorraine, right, this is the Dreyfus family, like one generation they're talking German or Judeo-German. They're German, another generation, or all of a sudden they're French, but they speak lousy French because they've grown up in German, and they're super self-conscious that they're not really French. And Captain Dreyfus is actually the first member of the family that actually speaks a nice, you know, sort of high French. So the point is, when you're in these interstitial spaces, you're, by definition, super conscious of your ethnicity because things are changing all the time. So he kind of comes out of that space. Okay. So how does the title of this in Hebrew is Drishat Zion, seeking Zion. How is Kalisher, is he moving the needle at all beyond where Alkali took us? Yeah, Joan. Okay. Okay. So what's that about? This notion of, you know, let's really, you know, talk about this kind of agrarian revolution. What's going on there? Very different. How does that represent a kind of a critique of European Jewish life?
It's critical.
How so? Yeah. Okay. They're not farmers. What are they increasingly becoming by this time? I mean, this is 1862. Jews have already been German and citizens of these different German states, Germanic states. Again, this is prior to the unification of Germany. That doesn't happen until 1871. But you have a bunch of these smaller German states in which they have been emancipated. They become citizens. They're moving into the middle class. Germany is this pretty dynamic place. It's like right on the edge of the Second Industrial Revolution, right? Going from certain metals to, like, you know, things like chemicals and stuff like that. So you get a lot of scientific activity that's heating up. I mean, intellectual, you know, interesting stuff happening in university spaces and technological spaces and the like.
They're mostly merchants, leaders in industry.
Right. So they're moving into the merchant class. But they're also going to university, right? I mean, this is before, like, the incredible boom of, like, Jewish physicists and stuff like that, right? People like Einstein and others. But the point is, they are pretty aggressively moving into the middle class. Merchants, merchandisers. So this sense of, yeah, they got to go farm. What's going on there? Like, that would sound like, hey, what are you talking about? Like, we just killed ourselves to go from being peddlers to opening up a store and maybe two stores. Maybe our kid, you know, my son, the genius, I'm going to wear his Phi Beta Kappa key. You know, like, my son's going to university. Like, he's going to become a doctor. Freud's parents come from a little town, I think it's in Moravia, like the kind of the hinterland. They end up in a big city like Vienna. So wait, they're gonna basically undo that trajectory of moving from countryside to city, of going from, you know, some crappy rural occupation of being a merchant or even a doctor or a lawyer. They're gonna undo that and become farmers? What's up with that? How does that sound like a progression? Yeah.
It almost sounds like he has a romantic notion of this. The same way, you know, people from Wall Street move up to Vermont.
Yeah, I got a rabbinic colleague. She's rabbinating out in Montana, I think. Very nice. Before they managed a hedge fund, then now they're in Montana, kind of thing. Absolutely. Like, there's this weird kind of romantic quality to it. Some sort of engagement with the embourgeoisement of Jewish life and saying, well, there's nothing problematic about that. So what are they, like proto-Marxists? What do you think, Carol, I mean, about this notion that, I mean, is this a kind of an economic, you know, sort of Marxian or neo-Marxian critique of Jewish life? I mean, where is this coming from, this idea that says, yeah, we got to go to Vermont, like we got to become Bernie Sanders kind of thing? Well, is that a political, cultural critique of Jewish life, or is it something else? Yeah?
Well, isn't it that, you know, they think that this is the way their redemption is going to be, because they know that as it is right now structurally, you can't, there's no food, you can't live there, so somebody's going to have to make crops and farms, and if you're going to get any international support from the diaspora, it's going to have to be the Jews.
Right.
So they romanticize it.
Okay, so there is a way in which the romantic thing could strike a chord among funders. They would say, look, I don't want to move to Vermont, but I'm happy to buy you, you know, 300 square acres. You can build, you know, bread loaf artist colony or whatever that thing is. That's what that was, I think, in Iowa or whatever. And there is some of that. There is this sense that says, I mean, who is talking about the problem of Jewish productivization? This is an issue in the 19th century. Jews are, at least in some circles, pretty preoccupied with their kind of vocational profile. Great. So what's that about? Fabulous that you brought that up.
Take the life out of air. There's not
what great writer writes a lot about this?
Well, a lot of Jewish writers, the Jewish Yiddish writers.
Okay, fabulous. The Yiddish writers, Shalom Aleichem, most famously, a lot of his most hilarious, poignant protagonists are these Luchmenschen. They don't really do anything. Like, they trade paper. Like, nobody really knows exactly how they make it. They literally, the Luftmensch is the person who literally lives on air. Doesn't have a real job. It's not like clear ultimately how they actually make a living. So there is this long tradition going back to the Jewish Enlightenment that says we need to become more productive. It's all about work. Good. It's all about re-engineering the body, re-engineering your sense of tools, your sense of aspiration in terms of not so much about wealth. It's not about like how to succeed in business without really trying kind of thing. Not going from the mailroom to the executive room in one day, like that's the fabulous conceit of that wonderful musical. It's not about that. It's about a much more profound sense that says we got the wrong body, we got the wrong set of goals, and the land becomes a kind of a part of this drama that says we got to get healthier. We got to get healthier psychically, physically, vocationally. Dan, yeah?
Is there something about self-sufficiency?
Yes, huge. Self-sufficiency is huge. We can't defend ourselves. We can't feed ourselves. We can't take care of ourselves. That's a psychic crisis, it's also a physical one. The advantage of the agrarian republic is that people can take care of themselves. Now, of course, what are the disadvantages of the agrarian republic?
It's hard work.
Number one, it's brutally hard. You may die. That's like Roanoke, right? To go back to one of the earliest Americanizing colonies, you may literally starve to them. Like, hey, you had this idea for growing this and this and this, and guess what? You didn't really know what you were doing, or there was a smallpox epidemic, and you starved to death. So that's one piece. You may literally not be able to do it. What else?
I was just saying that if they're trying to raise awareness and have people support them, there's no example. In the other countries like Italy and Poland, they have agrarian societies there. They don't have this.
Yeah.
So they don't want to be an outlier.
Well, so say that one more time, Peter.
They,
meaning these other countries?
The Jews.
Ah.
Who are trying to become a nationalist country. In order to be compared to other countries like Italy and Poland and Hungary, they have to have an agrarian portion of what they do.
An agrarian portion?
They need to have an agrarian, or they need to raise it. They need to grow it.
Okay.
Because how can they be seen as legitimate if they don't have that component that exists in other countries?
Right. Well, they are very self-conscious about the fact that they are seen as this kind of unnatural community because they don't have this agrarian element. But is ultimately, I mean, it may be necessary, but ultimately, is agrarianness sufficient to build a viable nation state?
Yeah.
Why not? Okay, and that includes what?
That includes
manufacturing. Again, back to our friend Hamilton.
Yeah.
Right, this is the classic American argument. You need manufacturing. Now, the argument then gets more complicated. This is like Brandeis v. Carnegie. Is it like a small manufacturing thing, like, five people working over lathes? Or is it like 15,000 people, in Homestead, Pennsylvania, making a huge quantity of steel for Mr. Carnegie? Well, no, but that's an argument, right, about which one is better for democracy and the like and the economy. But the point is that this will become the Herzlian revolution. Herzl will look at these guys and say, very nice, you got a bunch of colonies, people farm, you're healthy, you got nice hands, you talk Hebrew, you hang out with the Arabs, you eat hummus together, it's all very nice. But what you really need, if you really want to have a paradigm change, you got to have industry. You have to have a technocracy. You need engineers. You need power plants. Because ultimately what makes, and this goes back to the question that Karen and others talked about, what makes a nation state different than like a bunch of Catalonians just sort of hanging out, singing Catalonian songs by the campfire, and talking about how much they hate the Spanish, bastards in Madrid, is that you need technocracy to get bigger. You need wealth. You need an army. An agrarian republic will not get you an army. You need to get bigger, faster, stronger, tougher, and that's about industry, that's about banks, that's about cities. Very nice to have people in rural Vermont smoke dope together, make love together, sing songs together, Joan Baez comes to visit, it's all good. But that's not going to defend Vermont if New Hampshire decides to invade. For that you need a technocracy, and that's Herzl's great paradigm shift. He doesn't even know about Kalischer. But he knows about these other early guys, and he sees you guys are too much in love with this sort of agrarian ideal. See, the agrarian ideal, and you, I think, Peter, maybe you were trying to get us there, the agrarian ideal worked inside of what larger frame? Right? You run away from New York and you go to Vermont. What, you've like neutron bombed New York? No, it's still there. Churning out huge amounts of physical, financial, intellectual, social capital that's paying for all the things that are going to enable the lights to stay on in Vermont. It's going to pay for the police, for the borders, for the passport, for the army. That, in case you haven't noticed, that is sort of the frame in which Vermont sits. So yeah, you've got people like Tolstoy, these other guys talking about going back to the land, but that's happening inside of this gigantic thing called the Russian Empire. And you do have, I think I mentioned this a few weeks ago, you do have a lot of this kind of back to nature energy, the Boy Scouts in countries like Britain. They want to get boys out of these hellish places like, the crappy slums of London and Manchester. That doesn't mean they're blowing up London and Manchester. They're not blowing up this colossus called the British Empire and all their industrial might. They're simply saying, you know what, it's not so healthy to be living three blocks from a factory that spews out these awful fumes and you can't get fresh, potable drinking water. But that's what Herzl will say, which is, yes, it's very nice to go and go work the land. It will renew you physically and spiritually. But the question is, will that build critical mass for the Jews? Answer? No. And that's why these guys are stage one guys. Their instinct is you have to go there and you have to settle, but what you're seeing is already this very interesting dialectic of where is settlement, what are you going to need more of? Diaspora nationalist activity that is drumming up financial support, political support and the like, or dribs and drabs of Jews going and building these little settlements. You really need the former in many ways more than the latter. Because the former will create the financial, political mojo that will then enable us to go and do our thing. And this is Herzl's great insight, which is, you know what? This is why he sees himself as this kind of Moses-like figure. He says, look, I may never get to the promised land, but all those nights I spend in hotels in Sarajevo and Berlin and Vienna and London talking to Goyim and talking to Jews and trying to raise money and trying to garner political support, that's going to enable the pioneers to have a chance of actually being successful. And that, at some level, is exactly what happens. But for sure, it cannot just be about Vermont. Just like America isn't about Vermont. As wonderful as Vermont is, Chunky Monkey ice cream, the whole routine. But that's not America.
That's how we started.
Well, but again, back to Hamilton v. Jefferson. Hamilton says, you know what? If we don't get off the ground running with manufacturers, with industry, with the Bank of the United States, we got no shot of competing with the British. Chances are the British will come back, and guess what they'll do? They'll recolonize us. And that is almost exactly what happened. That's the War of 1812, etc. So that's sort of what Herzl is saying. I missed somebody here. I'm sorry to... We didn't get that. Let's start next time on Hess. The key thing for next time... I mean, I didn't bring... The texts from the Kaplan Penslaw Reader are fabulous because they will give you a sense of the texture of what this kind of early settlement actually felt like for these people. But the key text is auto-emancipation. And that's in Hertzberg. That's on page 179 following. Okay?
Yeah.
Questions, comments? You with me? All right. Good night, people.